Today's extraordinary life is the Usain Bolt of ultra-distance running. He's the comrade's king, a trained archaeologist, keen ornithologist, fanatical philatelist, connoisseur of fine wines, gifted raconteur, and one of South Africa's national treasures. He's also a man of principle who was pelted with rotten tomatoes for taking a stand against apartheid. In 2004, Bruce Fordyce was voted 64th in the top 100 great South Africans. Championing Bruce is another marathoner. He's got more than 70 marathons and ultramarathons under his belt, but he's now more famous for introducing banting menus to South Africa and making cauliflower more popular than the Beatles. Professor Tim Noakes, why Bruce?
Jonathan, because I've always had a great interest in the Comrades Marathon and it really changed my life. So I've always had an interest in the great names in the race. And I think Bruce is the greatest of them all. And I've known him since 1981, the day he won the race. We were doing an experiment on that day and he won the race. And as he finished, he said to the organizers, I must now go to be part of Dr. Noakes' experiment.
What was the experiment?
We were trying to find out whether you should take carbohydrates and lots of sugar during the comrades. So we were trying to see if the guys were finishing the race with low blood glucose levels. And guess what? We found that many were. And that was the beginning of the carbohydrate craze in South Africa, because Bruce and myself introduced with Bernard Rose the first goo, which is the carbohydrate that you take in a sort of plastic container.
Which is now considered poison.
Absolutely. So both Bruce and I are very unhappy with our pasts on that one. So Bruce has always inspired me, and I think that he managed his fame very, very successfully.
How has your friendship developed since 1981?
Yeah, it's just only got stronger every day that we've known each other, because I think we have great mutual respect. And when he went on this diet, it was kind of the final melding of the relationship.
Have you ever beaten him in a race?
I don't think so. But what he said to me was, Tim Noakes is a gold medal brain in a bronze body. And I had to remind him that I'd actually won some silver medals one in the Two Oceans, it's a couple in the Comrades. So I felt that was a little unfair. And also, of course, I was a lot bigger than him. So I figured if we cut the 20 kilogram or 25 or 30 kilogram difference in weight, I would have beaten him.
Joining us in the studio is Mike Finch, the editor of Runner's World, who also has a fair share of ultras under his belt. Mike, Bruce was born in Hong Kong in 1955 and moved with his family to Johannesburg when he was about 13, eventually graduating from Wits. Can you tell us about his early years and how he broke into the running scene?
Well, Bruce has got, he's got millions of stories about how he started running. And obviously his running career started off at Wits, where he became part of the running club. And there was a massive culture there of running. And there's a very famous hill actually very near Wits, which we did a story in Runner's World a couple of years ago, which is this kind of climb that goes up towards an athletic track just near the Auckland Park near the SABC studios. And he talks about that particular, I think the actual climb is about 414 meters long. And people like Mark Plykes and those guys always used to do this hill. And it became part of the culture of running. And I think he was following in the footsteps of people like Alan Robb, who at the time were his idols. And then suddenly he realized that he had the ability to do it. But when he talked to him when he was competing in the late 70s, I think his first comrades is in 1978, he didn't really see himself as one of the potential greats. He thought he could get a gold, and that was the best he would do. He always idolized Bruce, Alan Robb in particular. But when he beat Alan Robb, of course, it changed everything, and he changed the sport of ultra running in South Africa to this day.
When did you come across the name Bruce Fordyce?
Well, I actually just wrote my editor's letter for the June edition of Runner's World just a couple of hours ago, and I wrote about the memories of being on the Comrades, and there hasn't been a year that I can remember when I wasn't involved in Comrades. I grew up in Kloof on the route, and year after year, we used to camp out with my father and my family at Old Main Road in Kloof, which was one of the most famous spectating points. And Bruce used to go past, and every single year, Bruce would be behind at some point, and my dad would say, oh, he's not going to win this year, but he did. And then next year would come by, says, no, he's too far behind this year, he's never going to win it this year. And that was when he's sixth, then he's seventh, then he's eighth. And it almost became this routine about how far was he behind, And could he do it? And my dad every year would go, no chance. And he would do it.
That was the kiss of death when he passed.
Yeah, the kiss of death was obviously a story. There was many kisses of death with lots of different athletes, Mark Page and Bob de la Motte being the most famous. But he had this hold, and I think, Tim will probably agree with me on this. He had this psychological hold over the field. After he won about 4 or 5, there was something about the way that he just kind of, they knew he was coming and they couldn't hold him off. I mean, that's probably the right word. Mark Page once told that to me.
I think that's right. Mm. I remember the 1 year I was in fact doing the commentary, and in those days we only had one or two people doing the commentary, and it was the year that Hazare Charlie was way ahead of him, and I was watching very carefully, and that they filmed Bruce might have been 2 or 3 minutes behind, I think, at that stage, and the camera was on Hazare, and I saw that he suddenly stopped bouncing, and that's the key in the ultramarathon. When you stop bouncing, you're in trouble. And so Hazare was clearly slowing down, but the guys didn't pick it up. And then we went back to Bruce. Bruce was fine. I said, Bruce is going to win this race, and he's going to pass Hazare at a particular point. I forget where it was. And that came to pass. And I remember AC Parker, who was watching it, he said, that was great commentary to pick up when it was going to happen. I did that again a few years later for Bob de la Motte. And I said, Bruce is going to pass Bob at the top of 45th cutting on the down run. And it absolutely happened.
Well, it wasn't the top of 45th cutting. It was before 45th cutting, wasn't it?
There you go. And Bob de la Motte never forgave me. To this day, he still is angry with me for saying that.
The most amazing part of that story is if you hear Bob de la Motte's version of what happened in 45th cutting, I think it was 1986, there were two different versions of it. Bruce was like, it was basically the kiss of death. He shook his hand, but he gave it a bit of an extra squeeze to show he was still strong. Yeah. Bob de la Motte was like, well, I was still strong. I believed that it was going to be toe-to-toe to the line, and eventually Bruce did fall apart. So there's slight variations in that story, and I remember we discussed with them, the two of them together, and there still is that variation. And a slight element, still to this day, there's that little bit of animosity between Bob de la Motte and Bruce Fordyce.
I think it's a lot more than just a little, because Bob phoned me the next day. I mean, I got back to Cape Town, and before I got home, there was a phone. How could you say this? How could you say that? How did you know what I was thinking? And of course, he was quite right. But that was, when you're commentating, you have to interpret what you see, and you interpret it as you see it.
Yeah. Why do you think he had that hold? That's the one question I can't answer to myself. Yeah. Why did he have that hold over everybody?
I remember one of the runners from Cape Town saying, well, the way you beat Bruce is you just have to run the last 10Ks in 32 minutes or something. Bruce was the better athlete. I mean, that was the basic issue.
Has he been the best ultra distance marathon runner ever?
I think it's always dangerous to say those things. But in his era, he was definitely the best. I mean, he was the world record holder. And the Comrades is probably the toughest race at that distance. There are all these 100K races in Europe, and there are guys who run perhaps a little bit faster, but that I don't think they're as competitive as the Comrades.
So he's run 30 Comrades and 32 Ocean Marathons, winning the Comrades 9 times and setting records and the world record for the London to Brighton race in 1983. But of all these remarkable achievements, which one stands out as being the most remarkable?
He probably one of the Comrades where he set the record on the uprun. I think that, and Mike would know this better than I do, but I would think the uprun where he set the record, which took a long time for anyone to beat.
It was a downrun, actually. 5:24.01.
Yeah.
And it stood for 21 years until Leonard Fetsov broke it 3-4 years ago now.
Yeah.
So it stood for 21 years. And I remember that. I mean, it was remarkable considering the Russians that came out in the late 1990s, 2000s, and that record. And it was a downrun. Mm. I know Andrew Kalehe was the closest South African that ever got to it. And then Fetsov actually smashed it to some extent. But I think that was, for me, the defining... when you say, is he the greatest ultramarathon runner? I would say that was the one marker that says that he maybe could be, because there were so many fantastic ultra runners that came after him that couldn't break that time. Yeah, didn't even get close to it on occasion. Yeah.
So what is the secret of his success?
Well, you've got to start with the right genes. And of course, he was small, which is very helpful.
Yeah.
And he was clever. And I think also he was incredibly conservative. And fourthly, he was very scientific in his approach. When I say scientific, he measured himself all the time. So he knew exactly where he was in his training.
Yeah.
And everyone else was guessing. They come to the race guessing where they are. But Bruce knew because he did these repeated tests. And I must just add that we helped the Oxford Boat Race crew the past year. And the coach said it's the first time they went into the race knowing exactly, precisely how fit they were. Mm. And that's the key. And that Bruce worked it out for himself. So Bruce knew every day from January the 1st to May the 31st exactly what his condition was. And if he was ahead of the schedule, he would back off on training. If he was behind, he would speed up his training.
What was his training like? What sort of training did he do?
Well, the sort of turning point in his career was the second race in 1982. Sorry, he won at 1981. In 1982, in March, he couldn't run 5 kilometers because he was injured. And he got sorted out. And he was able then to start training. And he goes and wins the 1982 Comrades. And afterwards, he says, my goodness, I hardly did any training in January and February, but yet I won the Comrades. Now, the average person would have said, gee whiz, imagine if I trained harder in January and February, how much faster I could run. Bruce said, no, maybe I didn't need all that training in January and February. And that was the key. So he did his training in January and February, obviously, but his main focus was March, April. And so he put all this intense training. And he realized you can only train hard for a period and then you're out. And when Bruce came to the Comrades, the advice was you started training on January the 1st and you killed yourself. And on January 2nd, you went out and killed yourself again. And in a week's time, you ran a marathon and then you ran another marathon. And the key was in April, you were very fit, but by the time of May, you were over it. And Bruce learned that. He learned how to peak. And that was, I think, the key to his success.
It's arguably the reason why a lot of South African athletes have not emulated him to a large extent, is because there is this unbelievable fascination with the heart. You must train as hard as possible. And you see a lot of guys racing the two oceans every single year, flat out. And then, you know, within a year, I mean, the only person that's successfully done it is Stephen Mzingi. But over, he's never been consistently be able to win two oceans and Comrades to do well in both. So you're right. You only have a finite number of months and years in your legs to be able to compete at the top level.
How did he earn a living as a professional runner during isolation?
Mainly, I think, through speaking and through other engagements, because he wasn't a professional, he couldn't advertise. And so I suspect he got some money from running, but mainly from talking. That's I don't know if Mike has got any other further insights into that.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't actually know him very well in the 80s when he was at his peak. So I was obviously younger than you guys. but I mean, one of the most amazing things I often say to Bruce that I think he's sometimes a better public speaker than he is a runner. I mean, he's a superb public speaker. He's one of the best I've ever heard. And he's one of those guys that we think about, the last time he won the race was in 1990. And we're now 25 years later. He still is the guy that attracts the biggest crowd to our poster parties. He's still the guy that people most want to listen to. And I sometimes think that he doesn't even know that himself. I think he still doesn't believe he's got the pulling power, then he still does. And he's still the iconic runner in South Africa.
I must tell you just a little story. In the 1980s, Bruce and I used to do a program up for the Rocky Roadrunners Club for the Comrades pre-talks, you see. So he would give the talk in January and I would give the talk in April. And I would arrive home the next day and Bruce would phone and say, Tim, you had X numbers, I had X numbers. And we would debate who was. It was always a fight. He was always measuring himself in that way as well.
He talks about his first Comrades win when he wore the black armband to protest against apartheid as one of his proudest moments. Can you talk us through that first Comrades win?
Yeah, I mean, I, as I say, I wasn't there. I was a youngster back then, but I read up a lot about it and we've done interviews with him in the past. And he was a very proudly, he's not been shy of taking a political stance, even nowadays. But he's fiercely patriotic.
Yeah.
You know, he's got a bit of a gripe against the people who go to Australia. You know, he's always having a bit of a go at them on social media and that sort of thing. So he is very proudly South African. And I think he believes in this country enormously so. And he has believed in the country right from you know, the early years. But he's always believed in justice. And he took a lot of abuse, not just from people throwing stuff at him, but people abused him along the route, spectators, of course. Because back then, you know, it wasn't necessarily cool to be standing up against the regime at the time. So he took a chance, and he took a chance in an era where it was a risk, for sure. Yeah. So, you know, you've got to respect that. And the fact that he still won the race really sort of drove home his point even more.
Yeah. Well, he's captured the imagination of so many people, and it's rare that someone is so universally popular. What makes him so likable?
Oh, he's completely, he has no airs or graces. He's completely natural, and he doesn't think of himself as being anything particularly special. And so, and he relates to everyone, and he's got huge emotional intelligence. And it doesn't matter who you are, he will speak to you and talk to you as if you're an equal. And I think that's the key to his success.
And after running, besides public speaking, what does he like to do?
I know he likes a glass of red wine. He's very partial to, I don't know whether he does that anymore now that he's on the Banting diet, but you know, he's a very sociable guy, and you know, he's the person that's brought in the park runs to South Africa, and he saw the potential of the park runs. Now, park runs, just for the uninitiated, are basically free entry 5 kilometer runs that happen around South Africa, and there's 50 around South Africa at the moment, and they're looking at about 250,000 people on their database. And he understands that while the comrades and these ultra distance races have a place, you've got to grow the sport. And he's identified the park runs, and he's done an unbelievable job in promoting the actual event. So, you know, he's not just an old good runner. He's a guy that understands the way the sport can move and is actively moving the needle himself.
Yeah, I serve on the board for the park run, so I've seen it from the growth when it started with 10 people somewhere. And now it's the fastest growing park run in the world. And it's all because of him. It's because of his charisma that people want to be there. And literally every week he's opening a new park run. He and his wife are opening a new park run somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's been hugely successful. So successful that everyone's getting angry with him in other countries.
Bruce is turning 60 in December and he's in the twilight of his ultra career. But he still does plenty of running. Is that much running good for a person?
Well, the jury's out, because in my book, Law of Running, it says you can't get arthritis from running. And unfortunately, it's not true. And he's struggling a bit with his knees at the moment. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. The reality is that for some of us, there is a finite number of miles that you can run. And then your knees do pack up.
Mike, what can we learn from Bruce?
I don't think we will see anybody in South African running with the talent, the charisma, and the ability to communicate again, like Bruce. I think he is a unique individual. I think he is one person that his passion for the sport, his passion for South Africa as a true South African, makes him not only somebody that's a great runner and an iconic in that respect, but also a great South African. And I think when he appears in the top 100 South Africans a few years ago, I think he's way higher than 64th out of that. I think he is... he's one of the great South Africans, and I would put him in the top 10 of our South Africans. I remember there was a study done a while back about the two most recognizable faces in South Africa, and then was Nelson Mandela and Bruce Fordyce. And I think that is a better reflection of his real gift and his contribution to South Africa.
Tim, what is Bruce Fordyce's legacy?
Well, his legacy will be the comrades, because no one will ever... I quite agree with everything Mike said, and no one's ever going to touch those 9 victories unless they understand the way he did it and they have the special charisma, as Mike said about him. So there have been 4 or 5 astonishing runners in the comrades who've kept it going, but Bruce took it to another level, and he was globally competitive. And so I think that his legacy will be that he was just the most wonderful human being who achieved this unique set of performances, which will never be matched. And he left this huge legacy. And maybe the park run will be his second legacy.
Bruce Fordyce is a South African folk hero who in his prime could outrun anyone on the planet over long distances. He is the Muhammad Ali of long distance running, the Garry Kasparov of athletics, and the Meryl Streep of marathons. He's inspired a generation or three, encouraging people to get fit, healthy, and get outside. Bruce Fordyce is ultra extraordinary, or is that extra ultra ordinary? He's an extraordinary life indeed. Thanks, Tim. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks, Jonathan.